A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, Colton Dread on scene. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
You are just number six.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, Episode 5. This is a podcast where we talk all about British science fiction television, and today we will be talking about Box of Delights. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Xander from England. The Box of Delights is a BBC TV adaptation of a novel that was written in the 1930s. The adaptation was made in 1984 on the BBC television. And as I said, it's an adaptation from a reasonably well-known novel.
The setting of Box of Delights was in small-town England, and it was set in 1935 when the book was written. And the television version followed suit and was also set in 1935. And it was set around Christmas. Yes, we are actually covering a Christmas show during the summer. And the setting was in this rural, small-town England upper-class residents that had the children who were main characters, and there were some servants there. It was the classic, older-style English setting, as was used in many things of this type.
Yeah, it was very much sort of evoking sort of the cliched view of Christmas that people have. Like, it's there is a lot of snow everywhere, and everybody says, oh, there's always snow at Christmas. Well, in fact, in the UK, it actually isn't snowy at Christmas very often. The snow usually comes, if it comes at all, in January or February. So it's a sort of evoking picture book image of a British Christmas.
There's definitely something of Dickens' A Christmas Carol in the setting that they
Yeah, that's right. The book and the TV series is definitely a children's book. But I think it's a reasonably well-written one, so I think it also would appeal to adults. The story is a fantasy story, and it focuses on, not surprisingly, the Box of Delights, which is a magical device which has certain powers. One thing is that if you open it, you can look into and enter fantasy worlds. And the other things it can do is make you go swift, which basically means you can fly. And the second thing it can do is make you go small, which sort of reduces you to the size of about a couple of inches high, I guess, is it going by what happens in the TV series. The owner of this box, or the current owner of this box, has been pursued by the baddies in the story, and the whole story resolves around the Box of Delights, hence the story being called The Box of Delights.
The box itself has a very classic fantasy sense of wonder about it, and the whole program really evokes classic children's literature. The central character of Box of Delights is Kay Harker. Kay Harker is about an 11-year-old boy who is at boarding school and is coming home for Christmas time to spend the time at home. So at the beginning of the story, Kay Harker is coming home on the train, and it is through his coming home and the time that he spends at home that the events of the story unfold. Kay Harker was very much the classic young hero of the schoolboy novels. He is the central character who always wants to do the right thing and doesn't always know exactly what is going on, but has the strength to push everything through and drive the story. The character that younger children can identify with.
And the actor that plays him, I think, plays him very well, because one thing that some of these BBC children's dramas suffer from is that the young actors are sort of straight out of drama school and their acting is rather wooden. Whereas I actually think the actor that plays Kay Harker in this is actually very naturalistic, and you don't really notice his acting, so to speak, which is obviously a good thing. You just sort of take him as the character that he's playing. The second main protagonist is Cole Hollings, who is played by a famous actor, Patrick Troughton, who's most famous as the second Doctor Who. And he is the current keeper of the Box of Delights. And when you first meet him, he's a travelling Punch and Judy man, which Kay Harker helps out on the station platform. It turns out that he's much more than that. He's obviously a magical character and has magical powers, and is kind of keep this his Box of Delights from the people who are pursuing him.
Patrick Troughton was wonderful as Cole Hollings. He was a great character actor, and as good as he was in Doctor Who, he didn't get to show his character acting skills in the way that he did in Box of Delights or in some other thing. It made for a great character of the sort of older, almost hobo-type character being disheveled and doing this Punch and Judy show, and at the same time there was, as we learn, much more behind him. The main villain in Box of Delights was Abner Brown, played by Robert Stevens. Abner Brown was a very conniving, evil villain who was basically planning to get the Box of Delights for himself and wanted to have complete control of all the magical things and wanted the Box of Delights and wanted to get rid of Cole Hollings, and he knew that Kay Harker was involved and he wanted to just get Kay Harker out of the way. Abner Brown was a classic villain who fit all of the stereotypes of the villain. There are a lot of somewhat stereotyped characters in this program, but at the same time, they were well played and it was well written, so that worked okay.
Another thing to point out is that Abner Brown is acting in disguise to an extent. Him and his gang are pretending to be part of a religious training college, and he is, I think, the Reverend Boddingdale, who's the head of the college. Most of the adults in the story think that that's what he is and he's a good chap, and so when Kay goes around trying to point out that he's up to no good, no one believes him. So he's sort of a master of disguise to a certain extent, or at least he's managed to pull the wool over the eyes of most of the adults in the story.
There was a police inspector who Kay Harker goes to a number of times to try to blow the whistle on Abner Brown, and repeatedly this doesn't work, and the police inspector completely buys the disguise and the false pretense that Abner Brown is selling.
Yeah. I suppose another thing to point out is although you might think this character and some of the other characters are cliches, of course it was in 1935, so you could say that the archetypes came cliched later, and these actually did it first, or was one of the earlier versions of this sort of storytelling. When Kay gets to his house, he actually discovers that he's got a family of friends, children, a family of children who are obviously friends of him or friends of his family, staying with him in his house. There's a boy called Peter, who's obviously seems to be Kay's best friend and accompanies him on a lot of the adventures in the story. Peter has a sister called Mariah, who's very much a tomboy and goes around with toy pistols and saying that she'll basically shoot people and wants to get involved in catching robbers and things like that. And in fact, she does actually at one point go off with the baddies, although it turns out that once she discovers they really are baddies, she has nothing to do with them. There are two other sisters who don't play a big part in the role in the story, Jemima and Susan. The story concentrates on Kay and Peter and Mariah more than it does on the other children.
The other children were sort of filling things out to have some extra people in that group to fill things out. There were also other villains in addition to Abner Brown. You had the henchmen who were Foxy Face Charles and Chubby Joe, who were also pretending to be priests or ministers of some sort. You had Rat, who is this mysterious kind of character who appeared to be part human and part like a rat, and he sort of snuck around and followed people and things. And then you had Sylvia Daisy Pouncer, who was the nefarious love interest for Abner Brown. And this set up the backing for Abner and for the villains. So there was sort of a team that would go around and go after Kay and Cole and the good guys.
One thing that comes out in the story is that they also have been going around robbing, I think, his large houses and accumulated a reasonable amount of loot from that. And the other thing to point out is that all these villains seem to have a bit of a rivalry going on between them, that they all seem to be very quick to stab each other in the back. And when they're talking to each other, they always sort of nice to each other, but immediately when they're amongst themselves, they are scheming against each other.
The villains, including Abner Brown himself, reminded me a lot of bad guys from a gangster movie. They had that gangster villain will come and get you kind of sense about them. Possibly, again, because this is a 1930s novel, so it reflects that.
Yeah. The other major character, at least when she's around, is Kay's guardian, Caroline Louisa. It's made clear what's actually happened to Kay's parents in the story, but I guess they are not around, as he wouldn't have a guardian. I have actually read the novel, and I don't actually remember whether it is explained in the novel either. But she, yeah, it obviously is his parent figure, but for various reasons, which we may get into, she's not actually around very much in the story.
They do play the relationship between Kay Harker and Caroline Louisa in a bit of a different way than you would for a mother and son. There is a bit of a different relationship there, which was nice to see. That was played pretty well.
Yeah, she's more like a friend, I guess.
Don't be afeard, Master Kay. You see these things only because I'm here. Ah, but it's like old times to me. I've had fine times on winter nights when the wolves were after the stock. But I hoped you'd come, because other wolves are running, and they're running after me, and they're running me very close.
What do they want?
Not me. They want my box of delights that I showed you at the inn.
The TV version of the Box of Delights was one of the first series in on the BBC to use video effects that had just become available, basically to do the flying and the shrinking of the main characters, which are the effects of the box, as we mentioned earlier, and also the mixing of different imagery together. The two technologies they use, a thing called Quantel, which was the box which lets you basically fly things around the screen, and Chromacry Key, which is these days known as green screen or blue screen, which is putting things behind a colour backdrop, which you then remove, and then you put in a different bit of video to mix two things together. And I think it's done very well, certainly on the DVD. There's not too many obvious things where you say, ooh, that's a rather dodgy effect. I mean, they are effects of their time, but I think they actually come across pretty well. I don't know whether any of them have been touched up for the DVD.
My guess is that they have not been touched up, at least not very much. It looks like that original mid-80s feel, with, mm-hmm. I think, Quantel at the time was pretty new. Chroma Key had been around earlier, but they were getting better at making it work for things.
Yeah.
And the effects they had for flying people around and for shrinking things to scale looked reasonably good. It was definitely something that could be done at a moderate budget in the mid-80s, but it was reasonably convincing. The other thing they did, which was something that I really appreciated, was the use of animation. They didn't have some of the tools like digital effects and so on that were later used for generating creatures and worlds that were completely out of fantasy and couldn't be done on set. Instead, they did a lot with conventional cell animation. So going back to animation that really looks like something from a cartoon. And the interesting thing was, rather than using the animation randomly, they chose very carefully when they were going to use animation along with live action. So it stylistically represented fantasy worlds. So whenever Kay opens the box and goes into a fantasy world, he enters a world of animation, and it becomes cartoon animated. And there are a few things that are shown in our world that are animated, but it is always a sort of dreamlike fantasy. And it isn't a clash of two different things where, oh, we couldn't do this, so we used a cartoon instead. It really works much better than that. And there were some other programs later on that were done where they used a little bit of animation sort of as a cheat. It didn't come across that way for this. It's different than how things are usually done now, but it was really quite a nice stylistic look of this is a fantasy world and now we're in animation.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't any jarring jumps, because I think almost all the transitions are when you open the box, so you're sort of entering this fantasy world. via the means of the box, so you can say, well, that's the way things appear. And also, it's a bit, say, it's a bit like a dream world, so you can suspend disbelief that it's a drawing. And it was quite good animation as well. I thought it was good quality animation as well, which always helps.
Yes, it does. Stylistically, if anything, it's sort of reminiscent of The Wizard of Oz, where they went into the world of Oz and suddenly it was in color instead of black and white. So it had a bit of that this is fantasy feel to it. Another thing that was done was this was set in 1935. It was made in the mid-80s, but they went to quite a detailed extent of recreating 1935 with things like the hair and the clothing and the type of architecture you see, the houses and the places you were, the cars and so on. Even the things that were fantasy-based, the villains actually had a car that turned into an airplane. It was done in a way that fit very much with the 1930s. It is something that reflects the fact that the British film and television industry, and in particular the BBC, were always very good at doing historical drama. They did a lot of historical things from many different eras, so it was very easy for them to pick 1935, the year the book was written, and recreate that, because there were lots of people who were in the business of recreating different eras for film and for television.
Yeah, the other thing they point out is, that I mentioned earlier, is that all the external scenes, there's snow on the ground, and most of the scenes, it's real snow, and they actually went to Scotland, to the place where they could have the highest percentage chance of getting snowfall at the time of year they were filming it, which was in the winter, obviously. And in fact, they had a freak snowstorm, and they got more snow than they could handle, almost. There are some quite spectacular scenes of huge vistas of snow, which I'm sure Brian knows all about, but in the UK that's very rare, fairly rare, especially down south where I live.
There were a few scenes where they did not have snow and they had to fake it. Then you can see that they did that. It looks okay, but you can see it.
Yeah.
But there are a few scenes where you have several characters running around and struggling in full, fresh, deep snow. Yeah. And I do live in Canada. I know what full, fresh, deep snow looks like. And that was definitely real. You could definitely see that and how it looked and how they were stumbling through it. And that added to the feel of it, having some scenes in there that really had that feel of full, deep snow.
Yeah, yeah.
I look to you. Will you keep it and see that they never get it?
Of course. I'll keep anything you want kept. But if you're in danger, shouldn't you go to the police?
Ah, the police don't heed the kind of wolf that's after me.
As I mentioned earlier, I have read the book, although I haven't actually read it for a while, and as far as I recall, the adaptation is very faithful to the book. I don't think there's anything significant left out. In watching the TV series, the plot, although the basic plot is explained, the deep background to the story isn't explained in full. There are certain things that come up which you think, oh, that's interesting, but they're never really explained. And in fact, from my recall, the book is much the same. Is you have the group that Cole Hauling seems to be a member of, which Herne the Hunter is a member of, and there's also a woman that appears, and they all have these rings with crosses on, and they're obviously all part of some organisation, magical organisation, and that is never explained, and as far as I remember, that isn't explained in the book either. The other thing that might be worth pointing out is that this is actually a sequel, and there is a previous book starring Kay Harker and some of the same baddies, but again, that doesn't really explain. It's about a different events, and it doesn't really explain any of these mysteries that are behind the events in The Box of Delights. I think it actually adds to the mystery of the story that they don't explain everything.
It's interesting to hear that. I haven't actually read the book, so I was wondering if some of the explanations that seemed to be missing were there in the book, and they were just being too faithful to the book almost, in that they couldn't explain things in the way that the book explained them just because of the storytelling method, and had to drop the explanations altogether. But it sounds like that wasn't really the case, that they just followed the book's lead in not explaining some of these things. for example, who the old woman was.
No, I don't think she's covered in the book at all. I think about the only thing that might be a bit more expanded in the book is Sylvia Pouncer, the female lead baddie, because she, in the previous book, the sequel, she's pretending to be Kay's guardian. He finds out she's evil and thwarts her plans in the previous book, and I think that is at least touched on when he sort of sees her, first meets her. He obviously realizes who she is, and she knows who he is, and that is sort of mentioned in the TV series, that there's obviously some recognition going on there, but it's sort of lost over a little bit. I think probably in the book that's covered in a bit more depth, but I don't think that really detracts from the story.
Another thing that probably because of that was a little bit clearer in the book, it wasn't clear in the TV version why it was that Kay Harker was involved. You see Kay Harker and Cole Hollings have an exchange at the beginning, but the villains are interested in Kay Harker and concerned about Kay Harker as potentially being a threat to them and getting involved right from the beginning. They know he's there. They know he's important. They just want him out of the way, but they know that he's there and could get involved.
I mean, one thing that's interesting is that although he's the main protagonist, the Abner Brown doesn't think he is the main protagonist. because he's searching for the book, and he actually captures Cole Hollings quite early on and finds out he hasn't got the box anymore. And he's sort of fashing around trying to work out who has the Box of Delights, and he keeps ruling out Kay Harker, and it seems to be basically on the advice of Sylvia, because she, basically from her experience of being his guardian, I guess, has a very low opinion of him and doesn't think he's reliable enough that Cole Hollings would trust him with the box, which is ironic because that is exactly what Cole Hollings has done. Yeah, Foxy Charles and Chubby Joe are on the train when, basically almost in the first scene, on the train with Kay, and they sort of have interaction and they actually pick his pockets. And it's not clear whether they're just doing that for a bit of a laugh, as they're baddies and they do that to all little boys, or whether they're homing in on him specifically that early on. It's really once they've realised that Cole went to Kay's house that they really start going after the various members of Kay's household to work out who has the box. John Masefield was born in 1878 and lived until 1967. He was probably most famous as a poet, and in fact he was the Poet Laureate from 1930 until his death. The Poet Laureate is, I guess, sort of the Queen or King's official poet. I think these days, and probably in the 1930s, the appointment probably made on the advice of ministers. I think the Queen or King wouldn't actually pick the poet themselves, it would take advice.
In this case, it was on the recommendation of the Prime Minister.
But it shows his stature as a poet that he was picked for this prestigious role. And obviously this was before he wrote The Box of Delights, because that was 1935 and became Poet Laureate in 1930. As many children of the time, John Masefield attended boarding school, but apparently didn't enjoy it. And he actually joined the Merchant Navy, which is basically the civilian navy, before World War One. During World War One, he was actually a Red Cross worker, initially on the Western Front and then in Gallipoli. And in fact, he wrote a book about Gallipoli after the war.
Masefield wrote a great deal of poetry, and he wrote a few novels, including The Midnight Folk and Box of Delights, and some adult novels and various other things. But he did write a great deal of poetry, starting when he was quite young, and when he became Poet Laureate of the UK, which, as Xander said, was indeed a very high-profile, prestigious position. He took that to heart and wrote a lot of poetry for many years. In many cases, he wrote a lot of seafaring and sailing-related poetry because early on he was in the Navy and he sailed himself quite a bit. In fact, he wrote the well-known and very frequently quoted line, "And all I ask is a tall ship and a star to steer her by." That was part of Sea Fever, which was a little three-stanza poem. He wrote some very nice poetry, and a great deal of it, and a scattering of novels and various other things. He even actually wrote a libretto for Box of Delights to have it turned into an opera. And that included parts of The Midnight Folk, the book that came before Box of Delights. Unfortunately, I suppose, it was not actually set to music during his lifetime. It was set to music in 1980 as an opera by Robert Stedman. Masefield was really an author who wrote a great deal of different things, from all this poetry to adult novels and children's novels and a libretto and all sorts of things.
Interesting enough, one of the adult novels he wrote was actually about a character called Harker in one of his seafaring novels. I think it was sort of maybe a ancestor of Kay Harker. Brian has mentioned, and I touched on earlier, the prequel to The Box of Delights was a book called The Midnight Folk, which featured both Abner Brown and Sylvia Pouncer as the main villains, the same as in Box of Delights, but the events were very different. I haven't read it for a while, but basically it seemed a more dreamlike story, that all the events, as hinted in the title, happen when after dark, when Kay is sleeping, and it's very unclear whether the events are real or whether they're all in his dream. Although, in fact, you know, things like his real life guardian is involved and things like that. So there is a crossover between sort of this dream world and reality. So there are similar themes to The Box of Delights.
As you may guess, John Masefield and Box of Delights and The Midnight Folk are very high profile and quite well known in Great Britain. But in fact, and certainly in North America, they really aren't that well known at all, which is interesting. I believe these books are considered sort of children's classics in the UK, isn't that right?
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think, you know, well, previously to this television version, there were at least one, maybe two radio adaptations in the UK as well. I mean, the other thing I certainly noticed, having read The Box of Delights when I was a child, is that some of the themes and even sort of settings are repeated in the Harry Potter novels. Sort of the opening scene on the train seems very reminiscent, or at least the Harry Potter scenes on the train are very reminiscent of The Box of Delights. It's probably just coincidence, but certainly I felt that stylistically some of these things seem to be recurring themes.
That's interesting. I found it interesting that this author and this novel was something that, as I followed it up, seemed to be very well known in England, where here in North America, it really isn't. I've talked to people who know the standard children's literature quite well and read a lot of children's literature, and they weren't really familiar with this at all.
Yeah. I assume there are some classic British children's novels which are part of the sort of vernacular in North America.
Absolutely. The obvious ones being the C.S. Lewis Narnia books.
Yeah. Yeah.
And many others. This just doesn't happen to be among them.
Yeah, interesting.
I think that covers it for the first half of our discussion of Box of Delights. We will continue looking at Box of Delights in the next episode of British Invaders. So for the moment, this is Brian signing off.
And until next time, this is Ander saying goodbye.